Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Brad Stone to the broadcast. Brad is the author of the recent release, The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. Brad's previous book, The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon, was both a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller and won the 2013 Financial Times, Goldman Sachs Business Book of the Year Award. Brad is the Senior Executive Editor for Technology at Bloomberg News, a $9 billion global news and information organization. He oversees a team of 50 reporters and editors that cover high-tech companies, startups, and internet trends around the world. Brad also co-hosts a weekly Bloomberg podcast, Decrypted, and contributes to a morning email newsletter on technology called Fully Charged. Previously, Brad was a senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek and a technology correspondent for the New York Times. Brad holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in English from Columbia University. I recently caught up with Brad over the phone from his office in San Francisco. We discussed a number of ideas from his recent book, including the cultures of Airbnb and Uber, influences that continue to shape both companies, and the importance of startups having a full, strong executive team to guide their growth. If you like what you hear, we would be grateful if you would give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Brad Stone, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Peter.
Congratulations, by the way, on a terrific book, The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. I thought it was a fantastic read. I thought we'd begin where you began, or at least relatively early in the book. You described the process of getting Airbnb's and Uber's executives to speak on the record for the book. Can you describe kind of the process of making both companies and their executives comfortable in speaking with you on the record?
I don't think they're ever comfortable, because particularly for secretive Silicon Valley companies, they're never excited about opening the kimono and talking about history beyond the self-styled mythology as they like to create. I mean, I learned that when I did my book about Amazon a couple of years ago. You're asking for access, but the book has to proceed regardless. And that's always a big part of it, the inevitability of such a project. When I went to Uber and Airbnb for the upstarts, I thought the responses were pretty characteristic or pretty revealing. Airbnb welcomed me in. I immediately sat down with Brian Chesky, the CEO. It's a company with values around hospitality, and they were nice hosts, and they expressed enthusiasm about the project, and ultimately, and they gave me quite a bit of access. Now, of course, they managed that pretty heavily and tried to, you know, as all companies would, tried to shape their message aggressively. But by and large, that experience pretty smooth. Uber, on the other hand, you know, a little bit more of a combative company. And I went to dinner with Travis after a couple of months of asking to be able to pitch this project. And he basically, I won't swear here on the podcast, but he said, there's no friggin' way I'm cooperating with a book right now. And, you know, and I sort of expected that, and then, you know, kind of chipped away for another couple of months. And eventually, when they saw that I was sort of proceeding with it and it was going to happen, Travis started cooperating and gave me a couple interviews. And of course, I talked to many members of the senior team. So, you know, and it's smart. It's tactical on the parts of these companies when you have such a project, because, you know, they want to share their perspective. Both of those companies have plenty of critics, plenty of competitors, plenty of enemies. And so, you know, they need to aggressively share their story.
As you point out, very different cultures. What comes out in the book, I think, is, as you say, that at its grounding, at its foundation, Airbnb is a hospitality company. And a lot of that comes through, not to say that they didn't do some things that were quite ruthless in their growth. In some ways, perhaps that's even a requirement to grow at the pace that they have. But the differences between Chesky and Kalanick are pretty stark. In fact, you talk about how the shared experiences in some ways caused a bond between the two of them. You mentioned that Chesky would come back to Airbnb after these meetings saying, we have to be tougher, whereas Kalanick would come back from his meetings back to the team and say, we have to be nicer. What are your insights? Obviously, they're two different companies, but given some of the similarities and what they've been able to accomplish in disrupting and frankly being rather ruthless in a variety of cases, what do you draw from the different cultures that they have, either in their similarities or differences, and what importance do you put to some of those points?
Yeah, you know, both these companies rode the same fundamental wave of technology. They were extending the digital world into the physical one, and they were kind of marshaling the movement of people around cities, Airbnb putting people into homes, Uber putting people into cars. You know, they ran headlong into regulation, into city regulations and local politicians and unions and pretty entrenched companies. And because these companies followed a similar path, they had very similar challenges. That's why I think the opportunity was there to look at each other and learn from each other. They were jealous of each other to some extent. You know, Uber and the fact that Airbnb, for the first couple of years in most parts of the world, was able to sort of fly under the radar of local regulators. That's no longer true. We're seeing lots of pushback against Airbnb in lots of cities. But for a while, in places probably everywhere other than New York City, Airbnb almost got a free pass. Uber was a fight from the beginning. 3 months after it launched in San Francisco, it got a cease and desist. It had to battle. It had to marshal its customers together to go and persuade regulators to change the law or clarify the law. I think Airbnb would look at that and say, you know, wow, they really were able to like create a powerful force of their customers to go and pressure lawmakers. Airbnb was never able to do that as successfully because, you know, half their customers are out of town and traveling in the cities. And you know, in terms of the host community, some of them might not want to be all that public because, you know, what they're doing could be bending the law or alienating neighbors. While the challenges were similar and while they did learn from each other, they do have very different dispositions. Uber, just an attack dog, which served it very well until, of course, somewhat recently. Airbnb puts a nice little shine on everything. They talk about their regulatory brand and wanting to be in the room with regulators and talking to them, and you know, because they think that if they're just there, they will be liked. You know, whereas Uber doesn't really care about being liked. I've got points in my book where Travis would go into meetings with regulators and literally position his chair so that his back was toward them. Similar challenges. Lessons that they could learn from each other, but perhaps a very different disposition.
You also take great care to point out the number of companies, in some cases, that beat them to these ideas or certainly competed right alongside them and failed. And I wonder, as you think about some of those stories and some of those comparisons, in addition to the points just made, what were some of the differentiators that allowed a company like Airbnb and also like Uber to succeed, where others who had, as I say, in some cases beat them, in some cases had some similar ideas to them, but weren't able to succeed like them?
The easy ones to talk about are the ones that were just too early. You know, I didn't find, you know, those guys as interesting. To me, the interesting, what I call the non-starters, the juxtaposition with the upstarts is, you know, they had the same ideas. They were around the same time, but for one reason or another, they didn't succeed. And so I devote a chapter to these companies. Some ways, some of these other competitors were just too nice. You would have companies like Cabulous, which started in San Francisco around the time of Uber, but worked within the framework of the yellow cab industry. So giving phones and apps to cabbies, which of course didn't work because you can't raise prices. Prices are regulated by the city. And you can't add cars on a Friday or Saturday night because the number of medallions is fixed. And there's not a lot of consistency in the system because a cab driver going to pick up a driver who hails them over their phone, you might end up swerving over to the side of the road to pick up someone who looks like they're going to the airport. And so working within the system, playing by the rules, ended up being a kind of fatal flaw. Another company that was much larger than Airbnb, you know, in 2009, 2010 was called Couchsurfing. Very similar idea of home sharing. They registered as a nonprofit because they really did believe this idea that you were bringing people together and making the world a better place. And of course, it went nowhere because, you know, you're kind of hamstrung what you can do as a 501c3 And it took them years to go and try to make the necessary change to become a for-profit company. To abstract it out, I concluded that with a lot of these tech companies, you need a balance of idealism and ruthlessness. And when you have too much of one and not the other, it doesn't work. Some of these competitors to Uber and Airbnb maybe had a little bit too much idealism. And there might even be some examples where there was too much ruthlessness or aggression. There was a company called Sidecar, which you might remember, even preceded Lyft in terms of introducing ride sharing, or this idea that anybody could drive their car and pick up a passenger. And Sidecar, you know, not that it was necessarily ruthless, it was more aggressive in terms of going into cities like New York that wasn't so sure it wanted to legalize ride sharing. And they got their cars impounded and ended up paying a pretty steep price for being that aggressive. And they faded also. So I feel like the companies that succeeded, Airbnb and Uber, balanced it better. I mean, we might be seeing now, you know, that Uber is still a little lopsided on the side of ruthlessness and aggression. But both of these upstarts that emerged as winners had more of a balance.
Point that really comes through is the importance of a team, especially in the early stages. Travis Kalanick had Garrett Camp, who he admits actually some of the key differentiating ideas in the early stages were actually Camp's, who of course was in some ways the true founder before Kalanick elected to come on full time. He was the original CEO, etc. Chesky had Nathan Blacharczyk and Joe Gebbia as well. You mentioned, for instance, that Blacharczyk provided the spark that ignited Airbnb's inferno. Naturally, the CEO of any business tends to get, perhaps it's fair to say, more credit than they deserve. They are the front men in each of these cases. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of the surrounding executive team, the co-founders of these businesses as well?
Yeah, and this is what I love to do, is tease apart the mythology or the official stories of the companies and find that hidden aspect. In the case of Uber, we think of it as Travis Kalanick's company, but his friend Garrett Camp came up with the idea. He was inspired by, of all things, a scene in the James Bond movie Casino Royale, where Bond is looking at a pre-Uber Uber on a Sony Ericsson phone. It's like a product placement. Camp was having problems with, you know, he didn't like to drive in San Francisco. The taxi industry was horrible at the time. He was inspired, but he knew that it was going to be a fight. Thought Travis was the right guy to run it. And of course he was. And, you know, it was only until Lyft and Sidecar introduced the idea of ride sharing that Uber introduces UberX and really takes off. It's funny because we think of some of these Silicon Valley leaders as visionaries, but in a way, I'm not so sure that they really saw in both cases, Uber and Airbnb. They underestimated even their own opportunity. I mean, neither Garrett or Travis really wanted to run Uber in its early years. In fact, they hired another CEO, the first CEO, Ryan Graves. And it was only until the revenue line started to go up and to the right that they saw they had the tiger by the tail. In the case of Airbnb, you know, their two founders who graduated from the Rhode Island School of Design, Brian Chesky and Joe Gebbia, and then they had a third founder, really the engineering brains of the trio, Nate Blacharczyk. And they put themselves through college writing software for spammers back in the late 90s, early 2000s. He was brilliant. We call them growth hackers now. And it took Joe and Brian about a year to really convince Nate that Airbnb had promised. And when he did finally kind of turn his talents to growing the company, first they went through the Y Combinator startup program. And then when Nate kind of brought his growth hacking techniques to Airbnb, and I spent a lot of time with that in the book, you know, that's when the so-called flywheel took off. Hosts saw Airbnb as a promising place to list their homes. And then guests came, and because the guests were there, more hosts came. And that kind of chicken and egg problem was solved, and the flywheel started to turn.
Amazingly enough, the protagonist in your book, The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos, actually has a tremendous amount of influence on both of these companies. He's an investor in both of them. Amazon has 14 leadership principles. Uber has adopted 14 as well, some of them more or less lifted from Amazon. As someone who's dug in so deeply into all three companies, I'd love your own perspective on the influence of Amazon, but even more specifically, Jeff Bezos on these two companies.
I think every Silicon Valley entrepreneur right now, in some ways, styles themselves after Bezos. The fact that he has built a company that innovates at scale, you know, that is now hundreds of thousands of employees, 20 years old, and yet has spawned new things like the Echo, the Alexa voice recognition device, or Amazon Web Services, drones, even though that culture at Amazon is sort of famously difficult, he's admired for putting something together that works. You mentioned Uber's cultural values, 14 of them, many of them the same as as Amazon's 14 cultural values. When Brian Chesky recently introduced the Trips platform for Airbnb, so branching out into other kinds of travel services, not just lodgings, but tours and meals and one-day plane reservations, he referenced Amazon and its expansion from a books business into a full-fledged retail business. Bezos is sort of known for his boldness and his creation of a take-no-prisoners, high-achievement culture, perhaps a high-stress culture. And I think both of those companies, Uber and Airbnb, to different extents, have implemented the same battle plan. And look, I mean, Bezos is an investor in both companies. It's always pretty remarkable how he manages to do that. And, you know, and he's got, to some extent, relationships with both CEOs. You know, I think it's not a surprise that these are all, they're all heirs to Amazon.
I also found it really striking, having read both books, some of the similarities between Kalanick and Bezos, maybe a little less so with Chesky, but in terms of people that could be very difficult to deal with, certainly very difficult to work for, incredibly tough, kind of pushing people to do the impossible. And when they do, they kind of have that much more respect for the person who's pushed them to do so. Recalls Steve Jobs in sort of a similar vein, that a number of current or past employees of these companies would say didn't necessarily create an enjoyable culture, but somehow they knew that these were people that were sort of seeing around corners and predicting the future, perhaps in some ways that others simply can't. I'm wondering, as you think about that rare person who can be so prickly and so difficult to work for, but somehow attracts the greatest talent to be able to realize these visions that almost seem impossible, what are some of the things that come to mind as you reflect upon that?
That is so hard to pull off. Jobs got away with it because he had a marvelous intuition about what was coming next and a strong perspective on the future. And Bezos, maybe less intuition, because his strategy is more to try everything and kind of see what works and then do that. But, you know, he's been proven right again and again, and has obviously, not as the founder CEO, sort of mythologized. And when these young guys go and try to model that kind of behavior, and they sort of have less credibility doing it, and then you get the situation where you've got ex-employees telling tales of woe about how hard driving a culture was. And so it's like a tricky balancing act to pull off. I think maybe both of these CEOs, Brian and Travis, are still in the process of really proving themselves, which is amazing because Airbnb is worth $30 billion, Uber worth $69 billion. But they're private companies. Uber's not profitable yet. There's still a lot to prove. Until you do that, I think kind of modeling some of the behavior of these iconoclasts can be dangerous. Uber, I write a little bit about their corporate culture in my book, and we've learned a little bit more with some of the controversies they've been through. But, you know, it does look like a company that didn't put together the proper guardrails of a professional HR organization as it grew very quickly to from 500 to 11,000 employees in just a couple of years. Both companies, I think, marked by constant reorganizations. There's a fine line between being intuitive and sort of tyrannical about your perspective and then just inflicting chaos in your organization. And I think this is something that both of these companies are dealing with right now.
And obviously, Uber, especially in the news of late with several scandals, Kalanick coming out again saying he needs to transform himself, recognizes he needs to change. Not the first time he has said that. As you point out, when you go through the sort of growth these organizations have in the course of the past 8 years, there are a lot of dishes that are going to be broken. They're no longer startups, as you point out. These are growing behemoths. And as you reflect upon the changes that are necessary to go from startup to mature company, do you have a sense as to how well these two organizations will be able to pull that off?
Yeah, that sort of last mile to being public professional organizations. I think Airbnb has a little better shot of making a smooth transition right now. You know, it's really somewhat based on the team that you put around you, and they've got a very professional CFO from the Blackstone Group named Lawrence Tosi. Belinda Johnson, their first lawyer who came from Yahoo, has really embraced a bit of a COO role running Airbnb along with Brian Chesky. You know, Nate Blachersik, that the co-founder, has, you know, really grown with the organization and has a sort of chief strategist role. So they've got a pretty impressive team, and then there's other members of it as well. You know, and Travis, in his recent apology around the video where he was captured arguing with an Uber driver, I think he said something pretty revealing, which is that he needed some leadership help and he hadn't been willing to admit that before. And so it really is, you know, all about the team. Uber hasn't really scaled with the organization. The longtime kind of president, Ryan Graves, who was that first CEO, feels to me like he's, you know, a little bit more detached from the business. They hired a head engineer from Google who had to quit recently because it was revealed that he hadn't disclosed the allegation of sexual harassment when he was working at Google. And, you know, they don't have a COO. The CFO situation at Uber is sort of cloudy. I think they've maybe elevated someone into the role, but they really haven't had an official one for a while. If it is all about the team, Uber's got a lot of work to do. They don't have a professional management team right now, so they're building it. I think they've got a lot of work to do, and I think that perhaps that's one reason why they've had such turbulence of late, because, you know, they don't have a sort of full team around Travis.
Very interesting. Obviously, each of these companies are hailed as not only major disruptors, but also as changing the livelihoods of a lot of people in terms of traditional jobs. There's the concern that Uber will eventually be entirely self-driving cars, and so even the drivers will be eliminated. And I'm curious, forgive the sort of broad question here, what's your perspective in terms of the sort of disruption created and the path towards, or even the value to society moving forward and leading the sort of transformation that's necessary just culturally as a result of what is wrought by these organizations, you know, in our country and beyond?
Yeah, this isn't an Uber problem, really. It's just a technology problem and a sort of the future is arriving sooner than we think kind of problem. Dislocation and with drivers and driverless cars is coming, whether we like it or not. And Uber might lead the way, or Google or Tesla or some of the car companies might lead the way. But I live in San Francisco and you can't turn around without seeing a driverless car being tested, particularly down around Google. It's getting better and better. It's not hard to look out into the future and see that this is happening. Now, I think there are ways to kind of manage that transition, optimistic rhetoric. And Uber, you know, made some mistakes, or Travis, you know, made some mistakes early on saying that we're going to get rid of the other guy in the car and we're going to lower the price. And it just felt a little kind of cold-hearted. You know, we're at a place where, like, there's almost change fatigue. Obviously, there's a lot of sensitivity around job growth or lack thereof, and what technology is doing to our culture and our attention spans. And so, you know, these companies have to be careful as the transition is managed. I think they have to promote solutions to the coming job dislocation in terms of retraining or things like the universal basic income, be a part of that conversation, and then talk about it a little bit more gracefully, because it's going to be painful for a lot of people. I think it's to Uber's credit that they have gone in and spawned a self-driving car initiative. They knew nothing about that, but they knew that they would have to control their own destiny if, you know, they had a chance to survive, because this is an existential question for everyone in transportation. What is it going to mean when there are self-driving cars? So they've gone and spun up a fairly large self-driving car research organization pretty quickly, and they've managed to draw a lawsuit from Alphabet in the process, an IP lawsuit. They had to move quickly, otherwise they risked their business. This is a sensitive path to travel. A lot of people aren't going to give up the steering wheel all that easily, even if it's not their livelihood. People like driving, but, you know, there will be a pretty compelling argument to make when it comes to safety, traffic probably. So, yeah, we're heading into some years where technology changes our lives, and we're going to have a pretty serious and sensitive conversation about it.
Great points. Well, Brad Stone, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation.
Peter, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me, and keep up the great podcast.
I appreciate it.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.